You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, Ben Mathis here with a couple important announcements. You know that we have great advertisers that support the show and keep it free for you to listen. And one of the reasons why advertisers love Kick-Ass News is that they know the show has amazing listeners. Right now, we have a survey that I'd like you to take to help us learn more about our audience. Just go to podsurvey.com/kick. The survey will only take 5 minutes. We're going to ask you some questions about yourself and what you like to buy, but it's completely anonymous, and your answers will help us find advertisers that are well matched to you, your interests, and the show. And as a way of saying thank you, when you're finished, you can enter a monthly drawing to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Even if you've taken our podcast listener survey before, I'd like to ask you to take this one and help support the show. It'll be a big help to me, and don't forget that you have a chance to win that $100 Amazon gift card. Once again, that's podsurvey.com/kick. That's K-I-C-K. Thanks for helping us find the best advertisers so that we can keep the show free. Also, the holidays are upon us, and if you're like me, you'll skip the madness of the stores and do most of your shopping on Amazon this year. And if you're going to be doing that anyway, then help support the show by going to the sponsor page on our website at kickassnews.com and copying and pasting the Amazon link there into your web browser before you start ordering. Then Amazon will toss us a little something for every purchase you make this holiday season. You have to shop for gifts anyways. They've got just about everything you can imagine on Amazon delivered right to your door. It won't cost you anything extra, and you can help support the show. So it's kind of like giving two gifts for the price of one this year. And that, my friends, is what you call a Christmas miracle. So again, go to the sponsor page at kickassnews.com and copy our Amazon link into your web browser before you start shopping. And if you feel extra generous this Christmas, then make a donation to keep us going over here at GoFundMe.com/kickassnews. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis and welcome to Kick-Ass News. Today I'm talking with one of the smartest and nicest people in politics. No matter where you stand on the issues, you just can't dislike this woman because she's just so darn delightful and real. Former White House Press Secretary Dana Perino is the co-host of The Five on the Fox News Channel. She also appears as part of the political and election coverage on Fox News, and she hosts the weekly podcast called Perino and Steyerwalt, I'll Tell You What. Prior to this, Dana served for 7 years in the administration of President George W. Bush. Dana joined the Bush administration following the September 11th attacks in 2001 as a spokesperson at the U.S. Department of Justice and became the first Republican woman to be named the White House press secretary. After President Bush left office, she was nominated by President Barack Obama to serve on the Broadcast Board of Governors. She's the author of And the Good News Is, Lessons and Advice from the Bright Side, and she's now written a new book. The subject of her book is hardly surprising because he comes up all the time with Dana and her co-hosts on The Five. The book is called Let Me Tell You About Jasper, How My Best Friend Became America's Dog. And today, Dana Perino joins me from the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum for a conversation about the election, her time as White House press secretary, and how her dogs Henry and now Jasper have helped her keep her sanity in the dog-eat-dog world of politics. She'll share some wise advice she received from President George W. Bush and give us a glimpse into the character of the 43rd president. And she'll talk about the unique relationship between the press secretary and the White House press corps, which she affectionately characterizes as mutually beneficial destruction. She'll give some tips for the incoming White House press secretary and discuss her philosophy of achieving balance between work and life. She'll talk about the ability of pets to bridge political divisions between humans and why she considers the dog park her sanctuary and a strictly no-politics zone. She'll talk about how Jasper became a social media celebrity and gained the nickname America's Dog. Plus, she gives her rules for dog training and her suggestion for the next White House dog, coming up with Dana Perino in just a moment. Today, I'm sitting down at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum in Simi Valley, California, with Dana Perino. She's a Fox News contributor and co-host of one of the most popular shows on cable television, The Five. Dana was the first Republican woman to serve as the White House press secretary and served for over 7 years in the administration of George W. Bush. She's the author of And the Good News Is, Lessons and Advice from the Bright Side, and now a brand new book called Let Me Tell You About Jasper, How My Best Friend Became America's Dog. Dana Perino, thanks for coming on the podcast.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
You say that writing this book helped you get through the 2016 election. Was this a tough one for you?
Yeah, I would say the last 18 months, like most Americans, it was tumultuous and turbulent, fascinating. People were so into it. And I had this chance to be on Fox News daily on The Five and then appearances on The Kelly File. Plus, I joined the special election coverage team. So we were together through all of it, the debates, the primaries, those election nights when Donald Trump, remember, he said, "You're going to get so tired of winning." And I remember at one point, I'm like, "He's right. I'm so tired of winning." So then it culminated in election night, and I was on set till 3:30 in the morning. And for about 20 minutes afterwards, we stood outside the studio all saying, "Wow, that just happened. This is happening, America."
Yeah. Now, who was in that group after the election results?
Let's see. There was Megyn Kelly and Bret Baier. Mm-hmm. I think Chris Wallace might have been standing there. Chris Steigerwalt was there. Tucker Carlson. Just like the whole crew. Okay. We were all just sitting around afterwards, wiping off our makeup and trying to get some water.
Yeah. Now, what is the post-election mood like over at The Five?
You know, Eric Bolling was a big Trump supporter from early on. And Kimberly was pretty supportive, too, from early on. And I took a different view initially, and then I tried to basically be dispassionate about it and remove any emotion that I might have had from overhang from my years as a loyal aide to George W. Bush. And so I wasn't sure how it would be the next day, but you know what? The Five started, it was supposed to be just a 6-week temporary show.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so we've all been together now 6 years.
Wow.
And we had a lot of fun on this show the day after the election, just because it was all so fascinating. Juan Williams, who supported Hillary and was shocked, you know, he's an African-American man who is 62 years old. And I think that, you know, for some people, when I've been on this book tour, I've had a few supporters of Donald Trump and Fox viewers say, "You need to get rid of Juan Williams." And I say to them, "Why don't we pray for him instead? You know, he's heartbroken."
Yeah.
And political shocks take a while to get over. He's a great guy.
Such a good guy. I had him on the show a while back when he had his book come out. And
he's such a smart, intelligent person who has done a lot of research in America. And so it was funny, the woman that I said that to in the book tour in Colorado waited till I finished signing everybody's books and came to me afterward and said, thank you for helping me think of that in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
that's what really bothered me the whole election was all the anger.
Yeah.
I don't like anger. I don't like conflict.
Yeah. And it's like we used to be able to have civilized debate, you know, in the William F. Buckley era. You know, he used to say, what was the famous quote? He said, we can disagree without being disagreeable.
Yes.
And that doesn't seem possible anymore.
You know, in the first book that I wrote, and the good news is that one of the chapters towards the end is called Civility Lost and Found.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about how I learned as a woman in the Republican Party that one of the ways for me to survive and to thrive in a career was that I didn't have to own anybody else's comments.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if so-and-so said this on the radio the other day, I didn't have to own that. And once I let that go, that felt very liberating to me.
Mm-hmm.
But in that chapter, I do call out one person who I think you can trace a lot of the incivility in Washington back to. And that's Harry Reid, the senator from Nevada.
Yeah.
Who back in 2005 and 2006 questioned the patriotism of George W. Bush.
Yeah.
Called him a war criminal, said that he was a loser and a liar on the Senate floor. And it just devolved from there. And once you break the seal on incivility, it's really hard to put it back on.
Yeah. 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 There's no turning back from that. And yeah,
because then if you're civil, you look weak.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
Civility is so pre-2008.
I want to ask you a little bit about being White House press secretary, because I've never had this conversation with you. And you probably had the toughest run as press secretary under George W. Bush, because, you know, while there were other press secretaries, you're the one who came in at the end.
Yeah.
You know, when all the media was calling for his head over a rock after the Republicans had lost the House and the Senate.
The financial crisis.
Oh, my God. I've always thought, you know, and again, this is the perspective of an outsider. White House press secretary looks like the most thankless job in the world.
And it's interesting. I don't know whether, I have friends that have had children, you know, babies, and, you know, they say the labor is so awful, right? And then 2 years later, they're ready to do it again because they look back on it and like, oh, it wasn't so bad. So I don't know if that's how I feel about this job in terms of the post-traumatic stress of the job.
Yeah.
But I loved it.
Did you?
I really did.
Really?
In fact, yesterday I got an email from a reporter who had covered the White House all the years that I was there, and he's retiring. And he sent me a photograph of an email that he had printed that it's on his wall for the last 8 years since we left the White House. And it was from me to him. And it said, the subject line was, he wanted an interview with Joe Hagan, I believe. And I wrote back to him. I can't remember the exact context, but I believe he was agitating me for this interview. And I wrote him a note that said, you're being an ass and you can quote me. And he cut it out and he put it on his wall for 8 years. And I said to him yesterday, I really miss them.
Yeah, really?
I loved that job. It wasn't a partisan job for me.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought of myself as a spokesperson for the Republican Party. There was an RNC spokesperson, and that person had that job. That the job of governing is so different from campaigning.
Oh yeah,
and I really loved it, and I took such a humble approach to it, because obviously I followed in the footsteps of Tony Snow, arguably the best press secretary ever to be at the podium, and also one of the best men I've ever known.
Really?
Yeah, definitely.
Wow.
One of just terrific. And his loss was a tough one. You know, it's interesting also for me as the first woman Republican press secretary to watch these conversations about women in Washington and working in Washington. And if you think about the people that I worked with in the Bush administration, at the highest levels, everywhere I turned, if I needed an answer on something, whether it be national security, homeland security, domestic policy, economic policy, there were women in senior positions all across the administration.
That's right. That's
People
right.
forget
and no,
that.
Nobody gives him credit for that.
No, but he doesn't ask for it either.
That's true. That's true.
He's not much of a self-promoter.
It always seems like press secretary is kind of being
put between a rock and a hard place, because I'm sure that there's information that you maybe are not privy to, or for whatever reasons can't be, to answer questions about it.
It was pretty good for me. Really? I would say I had a lot of access. I will give you an example, though, of something that I wish they had told me.
Yeah.
Because I look back and it's one of my regrets. I don't have many regrets, but this one I wish that they would have told me. So go back to 2005 in the East Room. The New York Times has revealed that we have used enhanced interrogation techniques against terrorists who had imminent threat information and were reluctant to talk, and that our government made very tough decisions, legal decisions, but tough decisions, and asked our interrogators to do very tough work. But it saved lives. Okay, I knew all of that. What I didn't know until my exit interview, when I'm leaving the White House and you have to, after you have a clearance, you go in to say, I promise not to reveal this information. You sign on the dotted line. It was in that exit interview that I found out that only 3 terrorists had ever had enhanced interrogation techniques used against them. I didn't know that. I thought it was every Muhammad that came into the Gitmo. I mean, I had no idea because... Yeah. No one ever thought to give me that context. And I thought, if you had told that to me, I would have had an ability to push back on this notion that George W. Bush was torturing people that we picked up on the battlefield. It's 3 terrorists with imminent information. And so I hope that for future press secretaries, that they have the kind of access that I do, maybe plus some, because you do have an ability to keep the secrets that you need to keep. And what I would say to reporters, if they had a scent of a story, they were on the scent, and I couldn't tell them. I think the reason I had a good relationship with them is that I would say to them, I cannot say anything to you right now, but I promise you that when I can, you will be the first reporter I call, and I will not let you get scooped on this story. And I held true to that, and so they kind of gave me a pass when I needed it.
I mean, how important is it to be straight with them?
100%. I actually don't know any press secretary who's ever lied knowingly. I really don't. If you look back to one thing, Dee Dee Myers, way back when in the Clinton administration, she was given false information to give to the press when they were going to send that missile into Saddam Hussein's tent, right?
Yeah.
Is that right? I think that's right.
I think so, yeah.
Or bin Laden.
Yeah.
She was actually given... bad information and passed it on. That was not her fault.
Yeah.
So I don't know any press secretary who has ever knowingly not told the truth, because it's the surest way to hurt your boss or the country.
Yeah.
And also, I always approach the job as a 50-50 proposition, that 50% of my time should be spent defending and advocating the United States of America and the president and his policies and his decision making. And the other 50% should be spent advocating and defending the rights of the press to have access to the government.
Was the press fairly forgiving in those situations?
Maybe the hindsight is 20/20. No, I think that it's an adversarial relationship.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. How would you characterize the relationship? Friendly adversaries? Codependent.
I think honest. Yeah, a little bit mutually beneficial destruction.
Yeah.
if there is such a thing, right? Mutually beneficial destruction. That actually seems like what it could be. I had a pretty high tolerance for negative press coverage, partly because Bush did. Right. So he'd watched his dad go through it as vice president, and as president, they had that tough loss in 1992 that they had to deal with, like the Clintons are now. And then he was president for 8 years. So by the time I'm in the press office, he's had 25 years of dealing with what he would consider maybe biased media, but he respected them. I'll tell you what, he would, if I said you need to talk to reporters today, you need to answer their questions, like, he would do it. Now, he didn't always want to, and he would kind of grumble sometimes, and I'd put him through his paces, and he'd look up at me and say, you know, this is not my first rodeo. And I'd say, I know, but, you know, you're going to have to answer these questions. One thing that I had with him is a special thing where he says that for any press conference he ever did where I briefed him, he was never once surprised by a question.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Were
it's
you?
Kind of my bragging rights. No.
No?
No.
You never got thrown for a loop?
I remember one came totally out of left field about abortion rights that had nothing to do with anything that was in the news, but he handled it fine, of course, because he had core convictions, so you didn't have to reach for something there. But the reason I was able to do that is I took great interest in what the reporters were writing about, and even if it didn't have anything to do with us, I would read their work, maybe compliment them. I would also take into account that these reporters had a job to do. They had a story they had to turn at the end of the day, and their editors were going to be breathing down their necks, so I could either help them, make it a good story, or hurt them. And I knew what it would take for them to get on air that night for the networks.
Yeah,
so I could mimic all the reporters.
Yeah, that's smart. Now, you were the second woman to hold that post, the first Republican woman to hold press secretary. Yep. It looks like, from what we're hearing, Trump campaign manager Kellyanne Conway may be the second Republican woman to hold that position.
Oh, is that breaking?
Well, I don't know if it's breaking. I haven't watched the
news
yet.
I've heard Laura Ingraham is a possibility,
by the time
too.
This airs, who knows? So.
Laura Ingraham's also a possibility.
Oh, really?
I've
that
heard.
One I haven't mm-hmm. heard. Oh, mm-hmm. okay. Mm-hmm. Well, by the time this airs, then it might...
We might know.
We might know. Mm-hmm. So what kind of advice would you give either of them as a press secretary and also as perhaps the third woman to fill the role of White House press secretary?
Well, I think that once there's the third, like, you're good to go.
Yeah.
Right? That ceiling has been broken. You don't have to worry about that anymore. I hope that they do reach out to me because I would love to help them prepare. Obviously, those are two very accomplished women that we're talking about, and they know their boss very well. You mentioned like how hard it might be to be the press secretary at the end of an administration.
Yeah.
It's also difficult at the beginning. And Ari Fleischer and I have this debate because at the beginning, you're still formulating your policies.
Right.
And remember...
Press is probably very impatient.
Right. And you're going to make mistakes and you have to fill all of those positions in the government. You're trying to get your 100-day plan into place. And, you know, the Democrats right now, they are reeling and they're in total disarray, but they're going to get their act together. Mm-hmm. And so
what about the honeymoon period?
I think it'll be more like a weekend in Niagara Falls than a long honeymoon.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I just hope it's not a long nightmare. So we'll see. I'm assuming in the years you were press secretary to him that you got fairly close to him and saw a lot.
Mm-hmm.
What struck you the most about George W. Bush as a man?
Well, I would say a couple of things. One would be that I always knew that no matter what we were talking about, let's say it was even frivolous, like what I did over the weekend or my dog, Henry, at the time, there was always a look in his eye that you could tell he was worried about terrorism. And that was always on his mind. Like, are we doing enough to protect the country from another attack? I loved how he could make everybody feel comfortable in a room. I remember he went to, we went to a Baltimore jail for a faith-based initiative. And it was about helping, these inmates who are going to be hopefully leaving jail to help them transition and back into civilian life. And he went to sit down with them. And this black guy says to him, I can't believe that you're here and the president of the United States is sitting right next to me. And it was like a 12-step program, right? They were an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And the president said, I'm no better than you. And this was me.
Right.
I was right where you were before I decided to stop drinking.
Yeah, that's
true. All of a sudden,
people forget that.
The guy felt more comfortable, right? He could do that with people, including, I remember a guy in Albania. And it was we were there to talk about this state program where we helped with some microloans so that people could start a business. And this guy is there, and the president says, what do you do? And he says, I'm just a sheep farmer, and I'm just really not that important a guy. I just raised some sheep. Well, the guy actually had started off with like a small flock. He had a pretty big flock. And the president said, you know, where I come from in Texas, raising livestock's a big business.
Yeah.
It's a lot of responsibility. He says, so the next time I come to Albania and I meet you, I want you to tell me that you're a small businessman who happens to raise sheep.
Yeah. He had such a great common touch with people. And he really did. I don't think that, especially on the left, I don't think that that ever really came across or sunk in. That he's a guy with a big heart.
And a lot of forgiveness, too, right? He taught me to forgive.
Really?
When Scott McClellan wrote the book about his time in the White House, and it was considered mm-hmm. to be a very negative book for the president. I was so upset, devastated. Mm-hmm. And I got called into the Oval Office at 6:40 in the morning, and he asked me to try to forgive him. And I said, "Wow, well, can I throw him under the bus first?" And he said, "No, no one's going to remember this book in 3 weeks." And wow. he had took a very long view of things. He used to say in that last year, if I was telling him we're going to do an interview that was good for the legacy, he would really try to steer me off of that and say, you know, this year I read 3 biographies about George Washington. And if historians are still analyzing the first George W., then this George yeah. W., the 43rd president, doesn't have anything to worry about yeah. because I'll never know how I'm considered in history. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. You know, and it must be so hard to take that view of things, to be able to step away from it and
really
realize that in
me,
your
though.
Lifetime, you will never really probably be able to get perspective on your time in the White House.
But I love that because it helped me move on too.
Yeah.
And even now, thinking about, you know, having this chance to be an author and to be on mm-hmm. your podcast, to get a chance to be on television every day and to speak in front of hundreds of people. I try not to get a big head about it because it could all end tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I realized what he was trying to say to me, which is all the things that you do here are important for, it's important for you to do your best, but what matters is really the afterlife.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with Fox News' Dana Perino when we come back in just a minute. If you're interested in my conversation today, you should check out Let Me Tell You About Jasper, How My Best Friend Became America's Dog, by my guest today, Dana Perino. And right now, you can download the audio version of her book for free with a special promotion just for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be Let Me Tell You About Jasper by Dana Perino or any of Audible's 180,000 titles. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the podcast.
Now, you mentioned your first dog, Henry, mm-hmm. a moment ago. I think it was Harry Truman who famously said, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog.
And you know Charles Krauthammer says?
What does he say?
He says, actually, get 2 in case the first one turns on you. Which in Washington might be apropos.
Well, yeah, one might be a Democrat and one might be a Republican. So, did you find that having a dog kept you grounded
Definitely.
During your time in D.C.?
So much. And also, I think that it helped keep my marriage strong.
Really?
Yes, because when you're working 24/7, basically, with a few hours of sleep in between, and you're busy and you're traveling a lot, and my husband travels for business a lot, and you can have this distance that yeah. can set in any relationship, and you really have to work at it. And so the one thing that we could always talk about every day was to check in on Henry.
Yeah.
How's he doing? Let's take him for a walk. Did he get his treats today? Like whatever it was, mm-hmm. we could get him a toy. And he really became the center that pulls us back together so that I wouldn't just go upstairs and start reading my briefing papers for the next day.
Yeah.
And I think it also helps soften my heart because, as you were saying, the press secretary job can be one that's can make me, at least me, it made me a little hard-edged sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was a night when Peter picked me up from work and been a particularly tough day. Of course, now I can't even remember what the issue was. And I was mad at some reporters, mad at my situation. I knew what the next day was going to be like. And I caught a glimpse of myself in the side mirror of our Jeep. And I almost didn't recognize myself.
Really?
I was like, wow. I was just, my jaw was set. I looked angry and hard-edged. And Henry was in the back seat of the car. And when I got in, he liked to come up and put his front paws on my lap and lick my face. And it would just give me a moment to go, okay,
mm-hmm.
there is love in my life. And let me just calm down for a second and focus on my husband and my dog for a second.
Yeah, I feel like that's one of those things that
and
ground
also,
you and remind you that there's
and
life.
And also something to take care of.
Yeah.
That wasn't just a plant. And I don't have children. Yeah. I'm sure children are do that same sort of thing for a couple. But we don't have children. And so Henry, the other thing I write about in this new book is that looking back, because my editor said, dig a little deeper. So fine, let me think about it. So Henry, I get in England when I'm 26 years old. I had just gotten married. And I didn't even know George W. Bush when I was 26. I never knew I would go back and work in Washington and at a White House.
Yeah.
So Henry was with me from when I was 26 till when I turned 40. And in those 14 years, my life changed so dramatically, where I was living in England, not working because I didn't have a visa. I come back, I live in San Diego with Peter, where he's starting a business. I'm trying to find a job. And 14 years later, I was the White House press secretary, and then I was on this new show at Fox called The Five. And that's a lot of life to share with somebody.
Yeah, and it's like having someone who knew you back when, who kind of knows all of your flaws and all of your foibles, and when you're in a bad mood.
And you know you can't lie to a dog.
Yeah,
you just can't lie. You can tell a dog anything. And actually, a portion of the proceeds of this new book will be going to Companions for Heroes, which is a group that was started by a wounded warrior that had post-traumatic stress. And it was friends of his that recommended he get a dog to try to help with that. And he thought that was ridiculous. But he ended up getting a rescue named Cheyenne. And he says that dog saved his life. And so now he created Companions for Heroes. And they work to match up rescue animals with wounded warriors.
Great idea.
Yeah, it does. And it really does wonders.
Yeah, that's amazing. And this book was born out of a chapter that you cut from your previous book about the power of dogs to bring people together and even bridge political divides. Mm-hmm. Are dogs good peacemakers for humans?
Absolutely. And I think that that's true all across the country. Partly I saw that on social media.
Okay.
Right? So that can be like a nasty place, unless you're talking about dogs.
Right.
Then everybody can get along. Donna Brazile and I have been friends for many years. The first thing she and I always talk about, it's not politics, but... or scandal at any cable news company. But she has Chip and I have Jasper, and we always ask about him. And that's our icebreaker. The dog park in Central Park is leash free from 6 to 9 a.m.
It's a
huge perk. And one of my rules is no politics at the dog park. And so we all get along and talk about everything but politics.
Yeah, you talk about the dog park, which must be big, especially in New York City, because New York is not a dog-friendly place.
Actually, it is.
Is it? You think so?
Well, okay. People in New York love their dogs. Mm-hmm. But if you're saying like it's not the most conducive to dogs being able to go out and run around. Yes.
Right.
But I think that's one of the reasons New Yorkers take such good care of their dogs, because they have to walk them every day and get them outside, and because you can't just let them out in the backyard.
Yeah. And you talk about the dog park being kind of a sanctuary for you, and you have some rules for dog park civility. I have no experience with dog parks.
Oh, you might want to try it. You never know who you might meet.
Yeah, that's what everyone
All
always tells me.
All sorts of friends. Yeah. I love it there. You know, in our lives, Christians would call it serenity. Mm-hmm. You know, those moments when you feel like you're just where you're supposed to be. You're not worried about tomorrow. You're not thinking about yesterday. You're just there.
Yeah.
That's how I feel at the dog park.
Okay.
Always.
Really? It's that great?
It can give you an hour worth of peace.
What if I don't have a dog? Is that like being a single older man going to a children's park? Is it going to be creepy?
Well, you never know. You might.
I have to borrow one. Okay.
You might have to borrow one, or you might have to. You might have to get one.
Okay. See, but here's my thing. You know, I had a dog when I was a kid, and I grew up in my day when I was a kid. A dog is what you got when you settled down, maybe when you started having kids, or at least when you got married.
It's true.
Now I feel like there are so many single people with dogs.
It's about companionship.
Really, I know, but it's it was an addition to the family, not a replacement for
a
family.
I agree.
I feel like people are getting a little carried away, especially single people these days with dogs.
I think that
maybe it's just my thing.
No, I actually write in there some advice for younger people, millennials in particular, because a lot of them are not marrying young.
Yes.
Right? They're putting off marriage, and even though I tell them that love. Choosing to be loved is not a career-limiting decision.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's some really great advice you have in there about that.
But that I made a mistake made early on in my life with dogs. So when I was in college, my boyfriend gave me a dog as a present. It was a puppy.
Isn't that the dumbest thing to give someone as a present?
And I fell in love with this dog.
Oh.
And I was trying to keep it in the dorm room, and the dorm didn't allow dogs, and they would kind of turn a blind eye to it. And then the dog got sick, and it was very expensive, and I didn't have the money. And I ended up having to give the dog to a family that could take care of it, and it broke my heart. And so I try to advise young people, like, you will have a dog in your life, but wait until you have the means to take care of it.
Yeah. And I got to give New Yorkers credit, because I feel like more than people here in Los Angeles, New Yorkers don't really commit to a dog until they know that they have the wherewithal and they've thought it
and
through
and
they have a
plan.
Take
it to the doggy daycare.
Yeah.
Or hire a dog walker to come and help you in the middle of the day.
Yeah, yeah. Here in Los Angeles, everyone seems to have a dog now. And I don't know that they think, you know, then they go off to the office and just leave it there
dogs
alone in an apartment.
Yeah.
In the book, you talk about kind of an absurd incident in which your poor husband, Peter, got arrested and thrown in jail for not keeping your previous dog, Henry, on a leash. Now, that kind of seems like a perfect example of a nanny state gone wrong. What in the world happened there?
So we did a Facebook Live on this the other day with the Daily Signal.
Yeah.
Because I knew exactly what would be good for the Daily Signal readers. Rob Bluey and I are friends. I don't know if you know him. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
And this was based on a parking a ticket that Peter got from the National Park Service because he had Henry at Lincoln Park on Capitol Hill without the leash. But the thing is, Henry was so well behaved and walked a heel, and he never needed a leash, so Peter had left it in the car. But the Park Service man gave him a ticket. Then the ticket had the wrong information on it for where to pay. So it got sent back to him three times. And finally, as a newly minted U.S. citizen, Peter said, I'll have my day in court.
Right. He's
a
Brit.
And I said, but Peter, I think that comes with other complications in Washington, D.C. They raise a warrant for your arrest. He's like, that's ridiculous. Well, he did have to surrender himself in this thing called Operation Clean Slate, where you could go and turn yourself in, pay your fine, whatever. But it ended up, that story is outrageous. And he details it in the book that he basically, at one point during that day, was put in leg shackles over a ticket.
Talk about being put on a leash.
Yeah, he was. He was literally on a leash.
Oh, my God. And your poor dog, Henry, passed away after 14 wonderful years.
Yep.
Were you hesitant to get another dog after that?
Absolutely, because I felt the same way about we had just moved to New York. We'd been there 6 months. I knew that move was going to be hard for Henry.
Mm-hmm.
His loss was catastrophic for us. And Peter was collapsing inside. And he works from home. And I get to go to the studio every day and get my hair and makeup done and talk politics with people. And it's fun. And Peter's home all day alone. And it was Greta Van Susteren who called us the night Henry died about 10 p.m. And she said, I know the last thing you think you can do is get another dog, but I'm telling you, it'll be the best thing. So I told Peter that, and he said, how? We can't. I said, I know. I mean, there's no grass around here. At that time, we lived in Hell's Kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
To get to the park was about a 25-minute walk. And we went to dinner two nights later, still crying, and we decided we could do it. And the woman who used to take care of Henry when we were out of town and when I worked at the White House, she's a breeder of Vizslas. And Peter called her and she said, I had a feeling you'd be calling me. And I have a puppy that will be available June 5th. So we picked him up June 5th. And that was Jasper.
How old is he now?
4.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Jasper's become something of a celebrity.
A little bit.
How did that happen?
Well, remember the show Red Eye?
Yeah.
So Greg Gutfeld, I would bring up Jasper on The Five because the way our show works, our viewers get to know us personally, and we're very open about all of our personal lives. So when Henry died, I made that announcement, and then when Jasper was about to join our family, I would talk about it on the show and on social media, and Greg liked to give me a hard time about it. So did Bob Beckel, who was on the show at the time. And one night on Red Eye, we were talking about this Hollywood starlet who was so upset that the paparazzi were taking pictures of her dog, and she had demanded that they stop. And Greg said, Dana, would you get mad if the paparazzi took pictures of Jasper? And I said, of course not. I want to share my dog with everybody. I'll do all the work. He can be America's dog. So that's how the nickname got started. And then over social media, this illustrator
Yeah.
Starts making, taking pictures that I've taken of Jasper and put on social media, and then photoshopping them into these amazing scenes of Jasper in American politics and cultural life. And 3 years later, we collaborate together on this book that just has people in stitches.
Yeah, yeah. Half of the book is these photos that are pictures that he was photoshopped into. Mount Rushmore and is one of him at the podium at the Republican National
Convention. That was the first one. That was the first one. Remember, and that started because remember there was going to be a guest, a mystery speaker. And nobody knew who it was going to be. So on the five, we talked about who that could possibly be. It ended up being Clint Eastwood in real life. But that day, the Photoshop came across. That was the first one I ever saw. And get this, Ben. The illustrator, who I think is probably one of the best modern artists of computer-generated art, it is absolutely astounding what he can do and how quickly he can do it. He wants to remain anonymous.
It's like Banksy.
Except in a way.
Not criminal
and not sneaking around. Yeah. He doesn't want any fame or fortune. Huh. Although we did collaborate on the book together. I insisted he get paid for it. But
That's good.
Yeah, he doesn't seek the limelight, which is kind of refreshing.
Yeah. Now, how many Twitter and Instagram followers does Jasper have?
Well, the thing is, I make Jasper ride on my coattails. Or maybe it's the vice versa. But yeah, we're up over, like, I think we have about 1 million on Facebook and 1.3 million on Twitter.
Wow.
We're a little low in the Instagram department, only 124,000, but we're working on it.
Oh, okay. That's all the young people are doing Instagram now.
I like
that
Instagram.
Seems to be the thing. Yeah. So, yeah. You have some rules for training a dog in here. Is there one that is
kind of the golden rule of dog training?
I don't know.
Yes, I think so. So I grew up on a cattle ranch and watched my grandfather and uncles who were excellent dog trainers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the most important thing that you can do is if you get a dog, you have to have consistency. And the family has to have consistency. So everybody has to agree on the rules, on the commands, and on the treats.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody can be the soft touch. At least for that first year, because they'll figure it out.
Yeah, that's a smart rule.
And so, I would say that consistency is the very most important thing for training dogs.
Yeah. Every president has a White House dog. Any recommendations for who President-elect Trump and Melania what kind of dog they should get?
Or? I thought they had a dog.
Oh,
but
I
then
wasn't
somebody
aware that
said, no, that maybe like I'm wrong. Of course, we've not seen any pictures of it, so maybe not. I hope that Barron would like to have a dog in the White. I feel like Laura Bush said it best, that pets make a house a home, and that included the White House.
Yeah.
So they had Barney and Miss Beasley and their cat Dewey, named after the Dewey Decimal System. I just saw that yesterday the president went to the SPCA in Dallas, and he and Mrs. Bush have a new puppy they named Freddie. So they've always had dogs. I'll tell you, Barack Obama's dogs are gorgeous.
Yeah.
I had a chance to see them in person once, and I was shocked that they are gorgeous creatures. So for the Trumps, what kind of dog? Irish Wolfhound comes to mind.
Yeah.
Because it got the hair.
Is it a good life for a dog in the White House?
Oh, my gosh. The best.
It's got to be.
It's the best. You have someone to take care of you all the time. You got the South Lawn.
Yeah.
You get to fly on Marine One if you're going to go up to Camp David. It's a pretty good life.
Yeah, nothing better than that. Before we wrap up, in your previous book, you talked about choosing to be loved.
Mm-hmm.
The common perception is that if you want to work in the White House, you'll be committed to signing away your life for however many years you're going to be there. It's ended more than a few marriages. How do you find balance?
I give Peter so much credit. And also, I remember how President Bush would always thank our spouses or loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I remember we got invited to Camp David once, and it wasn't for me.
Mm-hmm.
That was for Peter.
Huh.
Because I'd been working lots of hours, and it was sort of like a reminder, like, thank you for sticking with us here and giving a little bit of a perk now and then. I do feel that I hear from a lot of people that they're waiting for that perfect moment in their life to then commit to something. So they want to make sure they have the right job and they're living in the right city, and they don't want to move because they want to live in Charlotte or Chicago or even New York. And I feel like they put all these restrictions on themselves thinking that at some point, then will be the perfect time to find a loved one and to settle down and have a committed relationship. And I think actually it works the opposite. I got married fairly young for my age group, you know, at 26, but it was right. And I look back on it, I don't think I could have done any of this without Peter. And especially during this election year, where the social media side of the bullying part, you know, if I'm now 44 years old and it can still affect me, imagine how it affects children.
Were you bullied much from the Trump supporters?
Yeah, and very much so.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
It was bad. Although then I saw that 1 in 7 of them were bots out of Macedonia. I'm like, wow.
What in the world?
So they were being paid to do it, you know. I don't know.
No, is this paid from someone in the U.S., paid from someone in Russia, I wonder?
I don't know.
Wow.
Don't know.
Okay, that's news
but
to me.
But a lot of this was originating out of Macedonia. Huh. So I was.
That's
I think I can let that go now. But I remember my husband saying, what can I do?
Yeah.
And you know what we did? Because he can't get on Twitter and like fight back with people. Like that doesn't work. You know what we did? I remember saying, I'm like, I need to go for a walk. I need to put my phone down and get outside. So we went and we did walks in Central Park when we could with Jasper. And the interesting thing is now, over the years since Jasper's had a following, this one day we're walking along and this guy heard Peter call after Jasper. And the guy was jogging. And he stops and he says, wait, is that the Jasper? The Jasper from Fox News? And we said, yeah, it is. And then he recognized me. And I'm like, oh, hi, how are you? And he said, do you mind if I get a picture? I said, no, of course not. And I get Jasper into, I still call him Henry, get Jasper into position. And I went to get into the photo. And it was very clear. He didn't want me in the picture. He just wanted Jasper in the picture. And I thought, wow, my dog's really made it.
No, you should start managing him.
I gave him a new nickname the other day.
Yeah.
Meal ticket.
There you go. Yeah, what's his cut of this book?
He is very happy. He gets to just sit on the couch with me and have his normal life, which is one of the great things about dogs. But he's brought me a lot of joy, and I love being able to share him with people. And just in the book signings so far, I can see that, you know, I've found a way to bond with people and communicate with them in a way that they'll be open-minded to listen to my views, regardless if they agree with me. And it's a lot of it has to do with this commonality we have, love for our dogs. Yeah. And they love Jasper.
Well, again, the book is called Let Me Tell You About Jasper, How My Best Friend Became America's Dog. Dana Perino, thanks for chatting with me.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Dana Perino for joining me. And thanks to the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum for hosting our interview. If you enjoyed today's podcast, then you can order her new book, Let Me Tell You About Jasper, How My Best Friend Became America's Dog, on Amazon. Or you can also download the audio version of her book for free through that special trial offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Watch Dana Perino on her show The 5 weekdays on Fox News, and subscribe to her podcast, which she co-hosts with her Fox News colleague, Chris Steirwalt. It's called Perino and Steirwalt, I'll Tell You What, and it's available on iTunes and Google Play. Visit her website at danaperino.com and follow Dana Perino on Twitter at Dana Perino. Don't forget to take our listener survey so we can keep the show free and find advertisers who are best matched to you, our listeners. Just take 5 minutes to go to podsurvey.com/kick and take the survey. And when you're done, be sure to register for that $100 Amazon gift card giveaway. And once again, before you start your Amazon shopping this Christmas, visit the sponsor page on our website at kickassnews.com and copy our Amazon link into your web browser first. Then Amazon will kick us a little coin for every order you make this season. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.